Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, you got Japanese beetle troubles. A listener from New Jersey has a new take on an old trick that'll make you smile if those scarab beetles have been ravaging your roses. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, so we're going to jump right to that heaping helping at 1-888-346-9499. Mark, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mark. Where are you?
I'm in Traverse City, Michigan.
Yes, Traverse City. We haven't heard from anybody up there in a while. You guys just thawing out?
We're just thawing out, and not every day.
What could I do for Mark in Traverse City?
Well, I live on a small 100-acre lake that's spring-fed with no inlets and outlets, and the lake's in really good condition, and I want to plant some new grass and raise a sloped area down by the lake, and I want to be sure I protect the environment, so no pesticides and no fertilizers and stuff like that. It's about 15 feet from the lake. It's sloped. It's got a little break wall on it. I want to raise it about 18 inches to level it off.
Right.
And I've got some sandy soil on the property to do that with. But then once I get it leveled off, my question is, what's the best way to approach this, keeping in mind that I'm close to the lake and I don't want to, you know, obviously mess up with the chemical composition of the lake?
Well, you know, that's the dirty little secret of lawn care, Mark, is that grass never needed these chemical inputs. It was just selling to the fears of Americans, and then this American male competition of my lawn's going to look greener than yours, and until finally it would glow in the dark. But especially where you are in a climate like Michigan, a true cool season grass is going to be relatively self-sustaining. I mean, if you plant it correctly, and your timing is exquisite, it couldn't be more perfect. You plant it correctly and cut it correctly, you'll never have to feed it. And you don't sound like the kind of guy who would flip out if a weed showed up. You would just mow over it, right?
Right, yep. Less maintenance is a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. So now, is the area around the lake sunny or shady?
I will get about half a day of sun.
Okay, so what half of the day?
Morning.
Okay, so it's going to get morning sun. That's good. And then there's some shade from some trees.
Then we'll be in shade of the trees all afternoon.
But the trees aren't in the lawn.
No, they're cut back to the edge, what will be the back edge of the lawn, and then that's all natural ferns and leftover leaves and stuff like that.
Oh, that sounds perfect. What I want you to do, because we don't know really how the lawn is going to react to that much sun, the choice of grass is going to be somewhat critical. And I would say, because you want a good self-sustaining lawn, you should go out and get a nice turf-type tall fescue. That can take some shade. You'll find that the new varieties, the named varieties, are slower growing. They need less food. In reality, they can feed themselves. You want your grass to have a name. You want to make sure it's a popular variety, because in future seasons, you might need to overseed bare spots. And this way, you'll always know which grass will exactly match the grass that you have out there. I would try to get the seed down by August 15th. Your fall comes early up there in Michigan.
Some years we don't have one.
Yeah. Your soil is perfectly warm right now. And your grass will germinate in like 5 days. It should come up. Keep it moist when it's coming up, not too wet. If you can, plan before gentle rain. And then once that grass is up and growing, because it's a cool season grass, it will really thrive, even with your severe winters. It won't mind those winters at all. And your summers aren't as stressful as they are down here in Pennsylvania. So once it's above 3 inches in height, using a sharp blade, make sure you always cut with a sharp blade. Make sure you always return your clippings to the lawn itself. Cut it between 3 and 3.5 inches with a sharp blade. And quite honestly, man, I would see what it looked like after a couple of years before you would even think about feeding it. because it's a fescue grass and fescues are clumping grass, the most important thing is to be prepared to overseed some bare spots if they show up. And you would always do that at the same time of year. End of August is the perfect time to sow a cool season grass. It doesn't work in the spring, especially your spring, which is our winter. But right now, coming up, you've got the greatest window of all time, and I think it's going to improve the health of your lake.
Okay, super. I'll be getting to it then by August 15th.
All right, sir. Good luck.
All right. I appreciate your help.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Sarah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being had. How are you, Sarah?
I'm good. How are you?
I am just fine. Thank you. And where is Sarah good?
I am good in Mount Airy in Philadelphia.
Okay. The Mount Airy neighborhood of Philadelphia. A fine place to live. What can we do for Sarah in Philly?
Well, I have a hobby greenhouse. It's like a 10 by 10, so it's pretty big. You can walk in. It's detached. And I just built it, so it's my first summer. And I read on your site, you know, summer is not the greatest time for growth, and I've seen that. So it's really, really green in there, but nothing's fruiting. Particularly, I have these cucumbers that are just huge vines now and going all over the place. And I'm not sure if I should rip them down and they'll start, or if I should keep them up and they'll start fruiting when it gets a little bit cooler, because they have flowers and some tiny cucumbers, but nothing great. And this is the same, the vining for sweet potatoes I have in there and other things. So I just don't know what to do and how to get ready for the fall, where I hope, you know, it'll be useful to have a greenhouse, because it's been a tough summer.
Right, right. So you went and bought a hobby greenhouse thinking that you could grow in it all season long, including summer.
Yeah, I thought so, and I thought I'd keep it cool enough. I have a fan, and it's vented, and, you know, cool enough at least for some things, or some tropical things in the summer, but I'm just figuring out what works and what doesn't.
Right, right. The good thing is you have venting and fans, which is why your plants aren't dead. And I presume that these plants are now too big to move outside.
Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah. What happens is greenhouses are designed to concentrate the heat. You keep them closed up, and instead of having to set up a room of your house with lights and everything, when we get into March, somebody with a greenhouse, especially if you said yours is attached to the house?
Detached.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So
you
may have to introduce a little heat in there. But it captures an enormous amount of light, and that's the preferred place to start your seeds. You can start all number of seeds, and it's a great place to get early growth, and a great place if you keep it warm enough to overwinter tropical plants and stuff like that. But once we get into the summer, they can easily turn into torture chambers. They get much too hot inside. And once the temperature gets above 90 degrees, with certain types of plants, especially tomatoes, the pollen, they will flower, but the pollen will die from the heat. It'll actually fry. You need to do everything you can to reduce the heat in there. You got a vent in the ceiling, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Keep that open. Keep the doors open. Keep the fan running. A true professional would actually pull shade if you can't remove some of the panels, which would be ideal if you could remove the panels or roll up the sides. If you can't do that, a true professional would use shade cloth to go over top of the greenhouse.
So what about all of the vining and non-fruiting things in there now? I mean, are they're always going to be just green, and even when it starts getting cooler?
No, when it gets cooler, the pollen will be okay. But you also, a lot of these crops, not necessarily tomatoes, but cucumbers and melons and stuff, they need pollinators to be able to get to them.
Yeah, I think that's my other problem. Okay. So, is there anything I can do?
Yeah, yeah. You're just going to get a little paintbrush, and you're going to go from flower to flower. You're going to have sex with your plants over the summer.
Okay.
Hot and sticky sex, you know.
Okay.
So keep it cool, hand pollinate, and realize in the future that the greenhouse is going to be your best friend in the spring and in the fall. I mean, you'll be able to grow salad greens in there beginning in September and probably all the way through to next year.
Oh, great.
And maybe even over winter because they're cold hardy. You'll find out how to utilize it well. But quite honestly, a lot of people who have a hobby greenhouse like this, they just close it up in the summertime and let it cook to get rid of pests and diseases.
Okay. All right. Next summer, I'll do that. Thank you so much.
All right, Sarah. Good luck.
All right. Thanks.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be answering your garden questions live and in person during a very special meet and greet on Saturday, August 2nd. That's today for our Philadelphia area listeners, beginning around 4 p.m. as part of the 10th annual Iron Hill Twilight Bike Race and Street Festival in downtown Westchester, PA. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and beating Japanese beetles Garden State style. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Summit Responsible Solutions. Summit mosquito dunks and mosquito bits contain BTI, which naturally controls mosquitoes without harming other living things, including people and pets. Online at summitresponsiblesolutions.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a New Jersey listener has sent in a great method that she devised of beating her Japanese beetles. You'll love to hear about it if the beetles have been ravaging your roses and there's a lot of Garden State attitude to her technique. But mostly it's a fascinating phone call show before that, cats and kittens. So we're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Christy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Christy. Where are you?
I'm in State College, Pennsylvania.
At Penn State, perhaps?
Yes, one of the best reasons to be here.
Okay. What can we do for Christy in State College?
Well, I'm working on my dissertation research, and I'm studying fusarium wilt, and I'm looking at pea and tomato systems, and I was just looking for more sites, so I was hoping that if anyone listening to your show is growing peas and tomatoes that I can sample, if they've had problems with fusarium or not, if they could send me an email, and help me create a substantial data set that can actually move Fusarium Control forward.
Oh, okay. So you are a grad student, and you're doing your dissertation on fusarium wilt, which is one of the two major soil-borne diseases in the United States. I mostly think of it affecting tomatoes, although I know, theoretically at least, it can affect a wide range of plants, right?
Yeah, the genus can infect pretty much every plant we grow, and I'm focusing on two specific groups within the genus that basically reflect that diversity within themselves. The one group can infect 120 different crops that we grow, and we only cultivate around 300. So it's pretty extensive.
Now, this occurs largely with tomato growers. That's one of my easiest questions when somebody has tomatoes that are, the plants are yellowing from the bottom up. And I ask them the obvious question, have you been planting in the exact same spot over and over again? And they say yes. And then I say that is either verticillium or fusarium. And I tend to equate fusarium wilt with occurring more often down in the south and verticillium wilt more in the cooler climes in the north, although the symptoms displayed by the plants, are, to my mind, are strikingly similar. Am I right or wrong about any of that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I'm going down to Georgia and Florida later this week to collect because they have a lot more samples there. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to reach out in this kind of platform, because it is much more rare here.
So does fusarium wilt occur in the north, or is it mostly a soil-borne disease? And one thing I want to make clear, that at least my understanding, is this is a disease that appears in the soil and then stays in that same little patch of soil as long as you grow susceptible plants in it. But if you don't grow anything there, you grow a plant that can't get fusarium, it'll go away after a couple of years.
Yes, that's the reason I'm doing this research, because the fungus will produce resistant spores that can last for a long time, and like fumigation is ineffective, and there's really no way to get around it, so people either switch to a resistant cultivar, which can have mixed results, or they plant something else, so there really aren't any other options.
Right, and this is one of the big reasons for grafted tomatoes that they've become so popular again. People trying to use a rootstock that's highly resistant to these wilts to grow the type of tomato on top that they want.
Yeah, because if you add the resistance genes, you lose a lot of the qualities of the tomato that consumers want.
Right, so you graft the variety that they like on top of a lousy-tasting tomato, but the only part of that is going to be in the roots.
Exactly.
Let's get specific here. Do you have a time frame? Do you have a schedule?
Right now I'm doing a giant loop down to like Chattanooga, Florida, and then back up the East Coast. And then I was planning on going out to Michigan in early August, and then late August, California. So anything in between is fair game.
Is there a website where people can map you, or do you just want people to email you?
I was hoping to start with email, and if I get enough responses, then it might be worth setting something up.
Okay, so obviously we'll take a note and we'll put the email up at our website.
Sure. So it's KAF326 at PSU.edu.
Okay, so the letters KAF, the numbers 326 at PSU, mm-hmm. which stands for Penn State University, and then .edu, which means it's a college.
Yep.
Okay. All right, we will be a part of your fusarium madness, and we hope that some of our southern listeners can help you out with samples of soil around their tomatoes, because obviously the end result years from now might be new techniques to fight fusarium wilt.
Yeah, that's the goal. Any help is greatly appreciated.
All right, we'll put the information up on our website, and good fusarium hunting to you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Ron, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Ron. How are you, sir?
I'm doing wonderful today, and yourself?
I am sitting up, taking nourishment. I have no complaint.
Well, that's good to hear.
Where is Ron wonderful?
Spokane Valley, Washington.
Oh, okay. I have friends who just got back from Spokane, and they said it was really dry.
It's dry, it's hot, yes, all of the above.
Yeah, okay. So what can we do for Ron in Great Spokane, Washington?
Well, the wife and I have got a wonderful little tree, a contorted filbert.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no clue on how to trim or to do anything to the contorted filbert. It's about 3 years old.
Well, do you know what the most common name of your, quote, contorted filbert is?
I have no clue.
Harry Lauder's walking stick.
Oh, okay.
So that's what you have, and you're not going to find, you know, a contorted filbert listed anywhere on the internet. But if you search Harry Lauder's walking stick, you'll find you are one of a group of crazed, absolute crazed fanatics.
That would make sense.
And I will ask you the obvious question, that because this plant has been adapted, if you look down, for instance, when you bought the plant, did you notice that it was grafted, that it was one plant spliced on top of another?
I did not. Okay. No, I did not notice that.
If you like the contortion, if you like the craziness of the branches, you always want to make sure that that graft stays above soil. Because,
oh, okay.
Because if the graft gets covered, you'll get normal filbert branches.
We don't have those.
Right.
It is crazy and twisting and going all sorts of directions.
And it gets a lot of comments, right?
Well, actually, that's the question I've got, is because it is, it's green, it's very healthy. You really can't see the contortions because it really looks like it's just got a big old green helmet on it. Because it's just, so many large green leaves, you really can't see all the contortions of the branches. Which leads me to the question is, how do we trim this back? And, my wife seems to think it's something almost like you would do with the Japanese trees that you trim up.
Oh, a bonsai.
Like a bonsai, correct.
I would think not. Now, first of all, you see the skeleton in the wintertime, right?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Okay, so the wintertime is your time. The wintertime, when you see that skeleton, that's when you can look at this tree, at the bones of it. And there's probably no more perfect plant to use that horticultural expression, the bones of a tree. And in the dead of winter, in January, that's when you can go out and look at that tree and say, if I remove this branch here, and this branch here, and this branch down over here, then there's going to be some space open, probably in the center is where you need it to open up, to where you'll see the contortions even when it's in full leaf.
That makes perfect sense.
Now, if you had a shrub that you wanted to keep in a perfectly conical shape, like for instance on Christmas tree farms, they're always doing light pruning all growing season long, doing things that almost amount to full-scale bonsai, just very light with scissors, just clipping little bits off. That's not what you need to do. In the middle of winter, you want to look at the bones, and you can remove up to one-third of the branches. Now, for what you want, I think you need to remove entire branches and maybe create an open center so that you can see more of the contortion. But you'll do your original work this winter, and then the following year, you'll see what that hath wrought. And then every winter after that, you can keep removing a third of the branches until your crazy shape is really well defined, even in full leaf.
Nice, nice. That makes perfect sense. Appreciate all your advice here today, Mike.
Oh, you stay cool this summer and pray for rain.
All right, we will, certainly. And again, thank you very much for your help.
My pleasure. You take care.
All right, have a great day.
1-888-346-9499. Alan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay, Alan. How are you, sir?
Just another day in paradise.
And where is paradise?
Well, right now I'm in my car in Northeast Philadelphia, but my garden's located in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, across the bridge.
What can we do for Alan's garden in Cherry Hill?
I have a planter box that is made of paver material raised in my back patio. That's about 20 feet by 3 feet that every year I plant some sort of vegetables with my son. And this year I decided to try zucchini, yellow in color zucchini. Now the plants came up, and I have them boxed off at like in a 3x4 area dividing each type of vegetable.
Right.
Cucumbers and tomatoes and string beans, so on. The zucchini, about 3 or 4 or 5 zucchini clusters, I don't know what you call them, stalks, came up.
Right.
But all the stems and flowers are thin and I believe are male. What am I doing wrong? I got all males, and as you say, they're waiting at the prom for the females to show up. And I don't know how to get that to happen.
You planted these directly from seed?
Yes, sir, into topsoil.
And what have you fed them?
Miracle-Gro, and I do have some compost that I could dig up, but I haven't done that yet. Mostly Miracle-Gro.
Okay, that's 90% of the problem. You do have healthy leaf structure on the plants, right?
I do, and they taste delicious, and so do the flowers.
You're eating the leaves?
I sampled them, yes.
Of zucchini?
Yeah.
I've never heard of that. Yes, the flowers, yeah. The flowers are very edible. Well, I guess the leaves are too. Now we know that. Good.
It looks like lettuce to me.
Good. Okay. So here's the thing. It is not uncommon for zucchini and other summer squash. That's squash that doesn't store. That's non-winter squash. This is the yellow crooknecks and the classic zucchini and all the different shaped zucchini. Summer squash is very susceptible to stress. First, it's very normal for the plant to only produce male flowers in the beginning of the season. Nobody's really quite sure, at least I'm not quite sure why this happens, but it's very common. So you do need a little bit of patience. But then if the plants are stressed, too much rain, not enough rain, too much sun, or chemical fertilizer, then the plants will just continue to produce male flowers and you won't get much, if any, zucchini. Miracle-Gro is just a chemical salt. It's not a true fertilizer in any sense of the word. And if you have a nice raised bed like this, the only food any of the plants in there need is a 2-inch mulch of compost on the surface of the soil when you get ready to plant every season. If you do that, the plants will be very happy. They won't be overfed. When they're overfed these chemical salts, they can't deny them. They have to, you know, it's like they're being shot up with steroids. They have to accept this nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium at the levels it comes in, whether they like it or not. Whereby when you mulch it with compost, the plant just gets to kind of graze and eat what it wants and grow naturally. So no more Miracle-Gro or other chemical fertilizers. You probably haven't had to water very much this year because you've gotten a lot of rain. But do you do extra watering?
I do what you said, which is I soak them once a week.
Okay, that's fine then. Go out and get enough compost that you can at least mulch the zucchinis with, and then have some patience, because typically as we get later in the season, that's when the female flowers show up. So the girls always come to the dance late, and they avoid dances where there's a lot of stress. So put some compost down, give the plants a good natural feeding, and as long as the leaves look good and the plants look healthy, you're going to get your zucchini. It's people are often surprised by how late it comes in the season, but I think that's one of the reasons they call it summer squash, because you'll never get anything to eat in the spring. It takes these plants a while to get going.
I say, great.
All right, Alan?
Still hope yet.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, sir.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind gardeners to pick their produce promptly. If you planted sweet corn, start testing the kernels as soon as your plants reach the days to maturity date on their seed packet. Don't let ripe tomatoes sit out in the sun. They can lose a lot of flavor cooking away on just a single summer day. Pick peppers with pruners to protect the plant. And don't pick them green. True flavor and nutrition only comes when they achieve their final ripe color. And don't go looking for all the details under H for harvest in the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and dispatching Japanese beetles garden state style. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Summit Responsible Solutions. Summit Mosquito Dunks and Mosquito Bits contain BTI, which naturally controls mosquitoes without harming other living things, including people and pets. Online at summitresponsiblesolutions.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, in which we offer a new solution to Japanese beetle problems that is not only effective, but emotionally satisfying. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Worth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Mike.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. And your name is Worth, sir?
W-O-R-T-H, correct.
And you're talking to Worthless. We could get a team together here. And
that's right.
Where are you, Worth?
I am in Oklahoma City.
All right. Always good to hear from our friends there. What can I do for you, sir?
I have a pink climbing rose on a trellis by my front door. It was probably planted soon after the house was built in 1956, so it's well over 50 years old. And produces a cascade of blossoms every spring and gladdened many hearts with its bouquets over the years. But this spring, the foliage and flowers were skimpy and small, then leaves started dropping, and two months ago, and cane tips started to die, and last week, all that's left is a pile of dead thorns.
Huh. And
looking for a well-educated guess as to what might have happened and where I should go from here.
Did anything change in the surroundings? Did you spread mulch around it or feed it?
No, nothing. In fact, I've got three roses nearby that show no sign of distress.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Is this rose in a position, I presume you had a difficult winter?
Very cold. In fact, my backyard figs were killed to the ground for the first time in a long time.
Did they regrow, however?
Yes, they did.
Okay. What about snow and ice? Did you have to use a lot of salt?
Just a very modest amount.
So probably, even if it did get some winter kill, it would have revived. Roses are just as hardy as figs, and there was nothing nothing that you did. You didn't put wood mulch around it or salt it to death. There is a rose virus going around that causes distorted growth before the plant begins to die, but you didn't see anything like that, like weird mutant branches.
As a matter of fact, I did.
Oh. Okay, so, well, I guess the good news, Worth, is it's not your fault. You didn't do anything. It's like a virus. Well, it's not like a virus. It is a virus. And it's just like you having the bad luck to, pull open a door handle after the wrong person touched it. Somehow, it blew into your neighborhood, and this rose succumbed to it. Is there any chance that the root system is still alive?
I looked at it this morning. There is one green cane coming up.
Okay.
So perhaps there's still some hope there.
Well, and it's still early in the season for Oklahoma. How about this? There's probably a massive root system underground here, right?
Well, it's a 50- or 60-year-old root system down there.
Okay. Have you been pruning off the dead parts, the parts that look really bad?
All that I can reach, I've been pruning off, yes.
Okay. I would continue to prune off the dead stuff. I would keep it well watered. Is there anything around it, man? Is there any mulch, or is it just bare dirt? Is there ground cover around it?
It's pretty much bare dirt.
Okay.
It's right under a drip line of the roof, but it's survived 60 years right there. So.
Well, that green growth, I had the experience of saving a rose that had this virus hit it. So there are two things you can do, one of which is going to be easy. First, I want you to mulch it with compost. If you don't have any compost, if there's no municipal compost, go to a nice independent garden center and get a bag of high-quality compost. Not composted manure, not composted soil, real compost made from old fall leaves and stuff. And put a good 2 inches of that around it. And every week you don't get rain. In the morning, I want you to let a hose drip at the base of that plant for a good hour, but just drip, drip, dripping twice a week. It would be once a week in a normal climate, but with you doing your imitation of Death Valley now, we're going to do it twice a week. And as long as you've got that green part there, that's your hope for next year. Continue the compost mulch, water when it doesn't get rain. And who knows? Last winter knocked the bejesus out of a lot of plants. I believe we can fight these viruses off if we fight smart.
Well, I'm going to give it a try because the kids call this the Mother's Day rose, and it's provided gladdened a lot of hearts over the years. I'm going to keep it going.
All right. Well, like I said, get that mulch down quick of compost. Make sure it gets adequate water. Nurse it through this summer. And then next spring will tell the tale.
I will do that, Mike.
All right, sir. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
1-888-346-9499. Matt, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. I love the show, and had a question for you today about my tomato plant.
Well, thank you, Matt. And may I ask where you are?
North of Doylestown in Bucks County.
Okay. What are you giving us directions? Where do we turn at the Wawa? No.
Yeah.
You always turn at the Wawa.
So I've got some raised beds, and I've had tomatoes growing for several years, and they always do, you know, really well. And this year, they started off growing really good, but maybe starting July, after they had set fruit and everything, they started turning yellow and brown, and the leaves and the branches are falling off.
It's from the bottom up.
Yeah.
Okay. And have you been planting these plants in the same spots in the raised beds year after year?
Well, I've got four raised beds, and I've only done one bed of tomatoes up till this year.
Mm-hmm.
And this year I have two. So, but what's strange is the cherry tomatoes or grape tomatoes are all in one bed, and the beef steaks and the heirlooms are in another bed. And it only seems to be happening well, it happens a lot more, I guess I should say, to the larger tomato varieties.
What you have is not the most serious problem a gardener can have, because it's very easy to correct for it, especially in future growing seasons. You have one of the two soil-borne wilts. These are diseases. The primary ones are verticillium, which is the one most likely in your garden in Pennsylvania. And then as you go further south, fusarium tends to take over. But these are diseases that build up in the soil around the roots of susceptible plants. Tomatoes are most often affected. So the first year you grow tomatoes, everything goes great. Second year, you can plant right in that same spot. Third year, that wilt is going to begin to reproduce rapidly. And either that year or the next year, you're going to get that yellowing and the browning starting at the bottom of the plant and proceeding upward. Now, the first thing I want to tell you is anytime you see a discolored leaf on your tomato plants, you should immediately reach down and pull it off for two reasons. One, just in case it's not this, in case it's a communicable disease, this way you've removed the disease vector from the garden. But the most important reason is it makes you look like a better gardener to your neighbors if they don't see all these diseased leaves in there. Now, as to why some of your plants are affected and why some aren't, I don't know how you chose your tomatoes because you didn't know about this issue going in. But a lot of tomatoes have been bred to be resistant to these diseases. And when you buy the plants or buy the seeds, they will have letters after their names, specifically V and F. And those varieties are bred to be somewhat resistant to verticillium and fusarium. In my experience, this disease just doesn't affect cherry tomatoes, maybe because they're so weedy. It almost never goes after them. It is known to affect the old heirloom varieties. So if you have an old heirloom variety that's growing in the same spot that tomatoes have grown for several years, this was inevitable. And the nice thing about the heirlooms, however, is, you know, these big rangy plants, they keep growing and putting on new growth. So since this is the first year you've really noticed this, I predict your plants will, quote, outrun the disease. You'll continue to have to pull off the bottom leaves, but that's okay as we get into the humid part of summer. Opening up the bottom of the plant for airflow is fine. But as long as they continue to put on green growth, it'll be fine. And this generally does not affect the tomatoes. Okay. Your tomatoes should ripen up fine as long as you have a lot of green leaf structure up top. Don't pull off any healthy leaves, but do remove all the discolored leaves because they're not photosynthesizing anymore. Next year, plant in a different location. Make sure you mark where all your tomatoes were planted this year with popsicle sticks or little signs or something. And then if you start to run out of room, take a look at grafted tomatoes. These are tomatoes where the variety you want to grow, like a Black Crim or a Brandywine or a Georgia Streak or a Boxcar Willie, has been grafted onto a very resistant rootstock that wouldn't have grown good-tasting tomatoes, but it's the top part that's going to give you the tomatoes. This disease is only in the soil.
Okay.
So rotate, and then if you run out of space, look for resistant and grafted varieties.
That's awesome.
It stays in the soil for about 3 years, and then without a host, it dies off.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Matt. It's an important question this time of year. You helped a lot of people out.
All right. Thank you.
Take care. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. It turns out a dead Japanese beetle is a good Japanese beetle. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started in explaining that statement.
Well, either you're getting into the habit of letting other people write the show while you enjoy the lazy, hazy days of summer, or we've been getting a great run of listener suggestions.
Well, it's a little bit of both. And come on, answering questions is hard. I like it a lot more when people send in the answers. Makes me feel like Alex Trebek.
Anyway, Carol in Princeton, New Jersey writes, "The instructions on commercial Japanese beetle traps emphasize that you have to change the bag often or the smell of the dead beetles will repel the living ones. I decided to try and use that to my advantage. When a trap bag got full, I let the beetles in it die, punched some holes in the bag, pounded it a bit, and hung it on the cherry tree they were destroying. Complete success. No beetles attacking the tree. Now I'm going to trap some more and hang their corpses on my rose bushes."
Ah, yeah. Good old New Jersey justice. Maybe they should change their motto from the Garden State to, "We know how to make problems go away."
Okay, get serious for a minute. Do you think this will actually work?
Well, she says it already has worked, and I believe her. In fact, her technique is an adaptation of the old bug juice trick that many farmers and organic gardeners used to rely on.
Bug juice?
Yeah, at least as far back as the 60s, and maybe earlier, growers would capture a number of the pest insects that were attacking a certain crop, put them into an old blender with about a pint of water, whiz it up, strain it, and then put it into a sprayer, and soak the plants under attack with the juice in the hopes that incoming live insects would smell what had happened to their relatives and retreat. The tactic has always been especially popular with Japanese beetles, perhaps because they're so easy to catch, even without traps. During a severe invasion, a pair of gardeners working together can easily knock 100 or so into a bucket of soapy water in a few minutes.
Why soapy water?
Well, the soap coats them and prevents them from flying away. And it's actually good to have a little soap in the final sprayer mix, as it helps the beetle juice stick to the leaves.
Ack! Don't say that three times. So should Carol make beetle, bug juice instead?
No, I think her idea is an improvement. I remember how stinky those beetle bags got when they were full. And with her New Jersey attitude of also pounding them, the scent's going to be much fiercer than if the beetles were diluted with water. Besides, what gardener wouldn't like to pound a bag of the beetles that had just finished defoliating their plants?
What a festive summer image. Any other tips, like maybe impaling individual beetles on toothpicks as a visible warning?
You know, that's actually supposed to work with slugs. Anyway, yes, although Carol is using her beetle traps effectively, these devices can easily work against a gardener by attracting many more beetles to the plantings than would otherwise show up. It's because the lures on these traps are so effective. It's been estimated they bring four times as many beetles to the area than your plants alone would have drawn. But no trap can capture more than about half of the insects lured to it.
So you effectively double the number of beetles on your plants?
Yes. If the traps are right next to plants the beetles love to attack, like roses, grapevines, cherry trees, and raspberries. Now, the traps can be protective if they're placed at the outskirts of your garden to intercept incoming Japanese beetles before they can smell the roses.
Wait a minute. Raspberries? Are Japanese beetles attacking your wife's precious raspberries?
Well, I've only seen and successfully squished maybe a dozen so far. And they've only been on the leaves. They haven't tried to go after the fruit. If I had bigger problems, I would have a helper hold a bucket of soapy water underneath while I reached in towards them. The beetles have developed a great drop-and-roll maneuver that you have to learn to use against them. But I haven't had big numbers of these pests in a long time. Knock on wood, turn and spit three times against a Kinahara. If I did have enormous numbers, God forbid, I just might set up a few traps and try Carol's very attractive bag-o-death idea. Now, the best tactic for the squeamish would be spraying them with a light horticultural oil or insecticidal soap. And if you're in a beetle-infested area where it's been constantly wet, I would treat the lawn with milky spore disease over the next 2 months or release beneficial nematodes into the soil when it's nice and wet on some warm evening. Both are safe ways to eliminate the grubs that would have become next year's beetles. Well, that sure was an interesting look at turning the tables on those dastardly Japanese beetles, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to lots of previous beetle-battling ideas, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to beat my beetles if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And to avoid getting the annoying email that asks this question, where are you? Please tell us your location. Oh, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and see what's new at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is not Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant, Tricia Whiting, will henceforth be known as Trixie. Our hired hand, Matt Hudecky, well, he isn't quite up yet. I'm your host, wide awake Mike McGrath, and I'll see you again after a hard day's night. Many homeowners are looking at their trees with one eye and an ill-advised pair of pruners with the other. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal when, how, and why you should prune big plants, plus your fabulous phone calls.